All right, we had a brief little break. We just got done talking with Thomas Keenan, who just wrote a great book called Techno Creep. We're here now with Bill Horn, who's going to be doing a talk at 5 o'clock. Which room was your talk in again?
I forget.
Well, I guess as long as you end up in the right place beforehand, it'll be great.
It's called Echoes of Returns Lost, and it's about the history of the Telecom Digest, of which I am the editor and moderator.
Right, so it's the history of that... But you also have a very long history working in the telecom industry.
I certainly do.
How long was that of your career in the telecom industry?
About 25 years.
That is impressive. 25 years.
That's extraordinarily long by the standards of Ma Bell. I would have stayed longer, but that didn't work out.
We could talk about your talk, but I think you're going to talk about that later today at your talk.
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit about you.
Okay.
So, how did you get started and become interested in doing work with the telecom? Were you a big freaker when you were a kid, or how did that all work out?
As it happened, I used to hang around the AI lab at MIT when I was relatively young, still in high school, and was learning Lisp and good stuff like that, and, of course, the one true editor. And I can't get a reaction from this guy. He's tough. You know, but anyway, I was having fun, and one guy was of a mind to share an unusual device with me. Not colored blue, as it turned out, but still effective. And I was involved with some experimentation, which was relatively productive, but being a nice Catholic boy, I didn't think I should really do anything very, very extreme with it. And just sort of let it go after a few months of talking to various places that had never heard from anybody with my language or my accent before.
So you hung out a lot at the MIT AI lab?
Yes, I did. And
so then what did you do? So you graduated high school, and then you presumably went to college, right?
I did, but I had a little delay in there. I was, as Country Joe used to say, sent off to Vietnam, and... that was an exciting experience, to say the least. I got back and decided that I thought I would be working on radios. As it happened, I had been I had a commercial radio license, so I went to work for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts fixing radios in the state trucks and cars and so forth. Unfortunately, it was all just a temporary appointment, you know, as favor for a returning vet and so forth. And after about, 7 months of doing that, New England Telephone and Telegraph came and offered me a job. And that was what I thought was a permanent position. And everybody I knew said, well, you're on with the phone company, you're set for life. So, yeah, I know. And little did I know. But I said, okay, yeah, I'll go do that. And I went through a series of indoctrinations and all the usual courses. Except they weren't anything we'd ever use. I took, I think it was like 3 weeks or 4 weeks or something of a course called D18, which was the AT&T standard course for toll technicians in the AT&T network. I learned everything you could ever want to know about a 17C toll board and all of the inward dialing codes and terminating toll center codes and so forth on how to reach other toll test operators in various places and to lock out trunks and everything. And New England Tel didn't use any of that stuff. they had at best one L carrier setup, and it was really R carrier, but they called it L carrier because it went on cable over to the microwave station.
So you started off doing work with radios, repairing radios, and then you got picked up by a telecom company.
The telecom company, thank you very much.
Sorry, it's been a really long day.
I couldn't resist. They've got my brain in the jar, you know, up at AT&T headquarters. The AT&T, not the new one, not the interloper, not this lady Johnny come lately. The AT&T.
25 years is a long time. You did not stay in one position in the company, obviously.
No, I didn't. The technical part of it, the part I really liked doing, lasted about 12 years. And I was on the street for part of that because little did I know that the phone network, the phone company in general, had gone through cycles of layoffs for decades. And the guys who told me I was fixed once I got on the phone company were turned out not quite correct. I was laid off after, I don't know, first 2 years or so. Mm-hmm. And went to work in broadcasting, doing the things broadcast engineers did back then, mostly shoveling snow and clearing out the... The first thing they told me when they hired me, by the way, was if you're going to take the meter readings, which you have to take at the bottom of the towers, mm-hmm. you know, you'd be sure to leave tracks in the snow, because some guy had forgotten to do that, and the FCC had fined him for not taking his daily readings. So you had to take meter readings every day, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And if there had been any snowfall, you were well advised to leave tracks in the snow in case the FCC inspectors dropped by. We had a tiny little 500-watt sundowner, which is a daytime-only station, and two towers, and all of the proofs of performance and so forth that we had to do. I had to take a meter out every week and find the middle of somebody's driveway at the end of a certain street and take a strength reading there. I'm not kidding. It's in the license. It says yeah. you know, 8 feet from the wall from the street and 7 feet from the garage door. It's right there in black and white. You know, you should see these things. They're amazing. And go to the graveyard, and there's a marker named Grant, and there's a marker named Jones and so forth, and you have to stand midway between them and take your meter reading there and all this good stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Just as an aside, I was with WRKO along about 1977 or 78 or someplace in there, and they had a guy came to town for some official visit. I've forgotten who it was, the president or somebody, but he had parked out at Hanscom Air Force Base, which is the military air base in the Boston area. And as it happens, Hanscom was right next to a very, very big marshland where the WRKO AM transmitters are located. And I won't bore you with the technical details, but, you know, water is good for AM. It's just the place to be if you have a big AM station. But the guy that was out there manning the transmitter was a world-class birder. He knew everything there was to know, had books published and everything, really oh, wow. well-regarded. Yeah, and needless to say, he had the access to all of the towers and so forth, and he'd figured out the ways to get around on the marsh, had a boat that he could go around, take his field strength readings. And again, they were, you know, specified down to the nth detail. And he went out to take these readings one day, and somebody stuck an Uzi in his ear and said, "Don't move." So needless to say, he had wandered into the Secret Service security perimeter surrounding the visiting person, and decided that he'd better follow instructions and explain patiently that this large electronic device he was holding was not, in fact, a danger to the chief of staff or anybody else. Apparently, they did believe him. He got to take his readings, but the way he told it, he also had to take a trip to a local supply store to arrange for some new clothing. It was one of those situations that you get to tell many times over. WRKO was 50,000 watts out on AM, and as I recall, 15 kilowatts on FM. And it was a nice station, but you had to be careful where you took your boat if the president was in town at Hanscom Air Force Base. Most of my radio experience had been gotten at the MIT radio station, which was WTBS at the time. Mm-hmm. One day a guy from Atlanta showed up and said Ted Turner wanted to found the Turner Broadcasting System, and their call sign was in the way. So here's $200,000, and by the way, we own the call. And the WTBS guys said, "Well, yes, sir." They weren't a bind. I mean, it was one of those things where they had to improve their transmitter or lose their access to the frequency.
Yeah.
And they had only like a 10-watt transmitter, and they had to raise it to 1,000 or some odd figure like that. So they needed money very badly and very quickly, and Turner came along at just the right time. And now it's WMBR, which I don't know if MBR means anything, but TBS has gone to a better home. And it's funny how those things work in radio. It's one of those things. I had a good time in radio. I never thought of it as my calling.
Yeah.
It's the jobs in radio and TV seem glamorous from the outside sometimes, but when you're in the belly of that beast, you find out pretty quickly that the men and women who actually work there are there to sell soap, and they don't make any bones about it. They're there to sell soap, and if you don't get with that program, well, you know, I was very surprised. My first day at one of the Boston AM stations, when I was still I think it was a senior in high school or just after I'd graduated high school, I was working a summer shift vacation job, you know, to replace those who had gone off to vacation. And I was telling one of the other techs that the DJ seemed to have his watch wrong because he was saying just before 9, when it was actually 10 minutes before 9. And I remember how surprised I was when the tech told me that, the advertisers like them to push the time so the employees wouldn't show up late in the morning. It's a different business on the inside, I don't have to tell you.
Yeah, that's usually how it works. We had somebody, this was like their first Hope conference, and they were talking about how well-oiled and smooth all the operations have been. We do a good job, and it's really fantastic, but we make it look easy. It's really hard. A lot of things are like that. So you did a lot of time in radio, but you eventually came back to working in the telecom industry.
Yeah, I was the assistant chief at KDB AM and FM in Santa Barbara, California, when Ma Bell called me back and said, "Do you want to come back to work?" And it's a union job, or it was at the time, and you get just one shot at that. You say no, you're gone forever. So I said, "Well, I guess so. Yeah, I'll take it." And there I was back in Boston and back on the in-toll test again. And I had been in radio for, 6 years, 7 years, something like that. And I said to myself, you know, I don't think I want to spend the rest of my life doing this because I thought there was a future in it, but look what happened.
Yeah.
So I started going to school. I had some luck that I got involved in a preparatory program at the University of Massachusetts. It was never said explicitly, but I got the impression that some money had been shaken loose because they were having a lot of problems with Vietnam vets getting into crime and drugs and things of that sort. So
yeah,
there were some programs around, and that was the turning point in my life. I had the best possible education there. The preparatory program was especially designed for veterans, and it was all completely practical information about how to go to school, how to succeed at it, what was expected of you, what the definition of success was. One must be careful talking on the radio. No wasted time or effort.
That's good. Yeah, I feel like a lot of times, especially currently, our vets come back and they don't necessarily get given the opportunities to get their feet back under them. So I'm really glad that you had that opportunity.
As was I. I did enroll at UMass and was there for about a year, as I recall, and did the time out in California because the job was just too good to turn down. But then came back to New England Tel and started going to Northeastern University and did finally get a degree from Northeastern. I had the highest of all possible luxuries. I had a Bell 212 modem, which did, wait for it, 1200 baud. And yeah, that was high living back then. That was that was, everybody else was making do with 300, and we used to use punch cards. Try not to laugh now, but we did. And the line for the punch room at the end of the term would be just around the block. You know, you just couldn't get in there and get anything done because everybody who was doing anything on the computers, which was my major, was trying to get jobs punched and get their decks run and so forth. I talked to my professor and the advisor there, and I said, you know, man, I'm holding down a job, I get responsibilities, etc. He said, okay, I'll get you an account on the dial-in system. And it turned out the dial-in system would take 1200 baud modems, so as it happened, I had one, or very soon had one, which was an official honest-to-God Western Electric 212A set, which had fallen off the back of a phone truck one day. And worked very well, thank you. It was relatively high living. I had a Zenith or Heathkit H89 computer, which I had built. And someplace in my archives of things that I never want to forget is a bill or a receipt for 16 kilobytes of RAM I had installed in it at a cost of $173.
Oof.
Yeah, it came with 48 kilobytes. This is static RAM, and it had a Z80 processor. But to get it up to the limit of 64, you had to buy the extra 16. $173 and change. And, it's a lesson in how the prices have gone in the computing industry.
Yeah, it's really impressive, especially when you account for, so you see all the old ads and then you have to realize that because of inflation, it's worth even more.
Oh, sure. I know. I had a occasion to clean out an old bedroom some years ago, and behind a dresser was a copy of Byte magazine from 1990 advertising a Western Digital hard drive having 10 megabytes of space for less than $10,000. And a good old RSI interface too. I don't know if you've ever seen or remember those, but that was only, it was like they bragged about it, less than 10 grand for 10 megabytes of storage space. So I had a good time, you know, got the degree and all that good stuff and went into craft for, until roughly 1989. And I had about 12 years in at that point. And unfortunately, the official history of the Bell system mentions a service crisis during the 70s. And it was well past the 70s then, but the service crisis was continuing because they had gotten in a bunch of employees whose definition of success was not getting caught and who generally thought it was acceptable to show up high as a kite and do very sloppy work, and all of their disconnects completed with a magic pencil, you understand. It got so bad in one location at Bowdoin Square in Boston, there was so much dead wire on the commonly used, do you know what a telephone company frame looks like?
No, I've actually never, I haven't
imagine
seen one.
A whole bunch of shelves going for miles, and I mean hundreds of feet, one above the other, where the wire is laid in to connect the dial tones to the cables. Well, these guys had never taken out the wire when they were disconnecting old orders, old phone numbers and so forth. So it started to spill over into the corridor, yeah. And yes. And there was no other way to fill out the new orders other than to run the wire, so they had to run the wire on the floor. And I know, the standard of professionalism had gone down dramatically. I had some good fortune. I came up under a guy named Grady. Jonathan, as I recall, but everybody called him Old Grady. He'd heard it so often he didn't really mind. And he was an old world switchman. He got to wear the tie, which was considered a badge of honor, you know, being in the craft, because he was a rated man. And taught me everything I needed to know about panel, which was that if you're going to work in a panel office, you were going to come home with the ordure of burnt brill cream on your clothes and in your hair, because panel offices just smelled of grease and motors and everything else. They were quite an affair. But, old Grady took me under his arm and taught me everything I needed to know about the phone business. His wife called me up a couple of months after he had passed and said she had some stuff that he wanted me to have, a collection of old Morse code instruments.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. It seems that during World War II, the copper was in such short supply that they couldn't install any new wires beneath the streets of Boston. So in order to communicate between the toll boards, the toll men had to learn Morse code, American Morse code, too. And they could arrange things in a way, again, I won't bore you with the technical details, but they could arrange the circuits in such a way that they could use four wires for regular phone calls and get another Morse code circuit out of it as well, so that they could, you know, they could communicate with Morse code on what their daily assignments were or which wire they had to work on and things of that sort. And, he was a hell of a guy, Grady. It was a shame. He was well past retirement age, you know, so it wasn't like he hadn't had good innings, but still I was sorry to see him go. He was one of the last of the old breed, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I did that until about, just shy of 1990, as I recall, and they started to put in new kinds of equipment, which were clearly designed to make the job, to dumb down the job to the point where marginally skilled people could do it. With 12 years of seniority, I didn't know if I could survive another layoff. And I said, well, time to get out of here. Remember that Heath kit I told you about, that H89? Yeah. I had a printer for it, which came in handy in school because, you know, having a computer with an electronic printer was quite the deal at that time. It was an Anderson Jacobson 841, which I had bought from the MIT Surplus Exchange for $55. Imagine an electric typewriter, a Selectric typewriter, mm-hmm. with solenoids on the bottom of it to pull the bars for you. And you could hook that up to a computer. But there was only one catch. it didn't speak ASCII. It didn't know anything about, yeah, I know.
Oh, boy.
It talked the IBM commercial code, which was EBCD, not the later version. This was a 6-bit code, and the extended binary coded decimal, I don't know what they called it, but it wasn't EBCDIC, you know. And it had a shift out and a shift in character, the same way Baud O had figures and letters. And you could print on it if you could get Heath 89 running CPM to understand EBCD code. And the point of all that is that I had done it. You know, it took quite a bit of doing, and I could tell you everything you wanted to know about how to program an Intel 8250 UART. One of those things you do because you have to, you know, that you learn because you have to. And I was just at the end of my career with the tool belt on. Didn't think I could survive another layoff, as I say. So I said, well, my degree's in IS, Management Information Systems. And they're looking for programmers, so I think I'll go apply. And they had this job fair at the some big, you know, meeting hall in Boston. And all of these clerks are lined up to get their picture taken behind the silhouette of the lineman with the tool belt on and everything. You know, all the girls wanted to be technical employees because it was quite a pay raise. But they had this literally old lady standing behind a table with, you know, IS people come here, and she was all alone. Looked like there wasn't anybody even interested in talking to her. And I walked over, and she said, "Hi, how you doing? You know, interested in programming? Ever done any work with it?" And I told her about this Heathkit thing that I had to adapt for an Anderson Jacobs. "Oh, how'd you do that?" And I said, "Well, I just followed the interrupt vectors for the printer routine up from the basic call, and put in a little lookup table to go from ASCII to EBCD, and a couple of control statements for the keyboard on and off statements that it wanted to have, and blah blah blah." I didn't think I was impressing her at all. I just, you know, thought, yeah, well, does she think I'm lost in the ozone or what? And she said, "Well, okay, I want you to call this person tomorrow," and wrote down a number and a name on the back of a business card. And I turned away thinking, yeah, that was a waste of an hour. And I got outside and looked at the front of the business card and realized I'd been talking to the vice president of data processing. And I looked in the company phone book the next day at the name she had given me, and realized that I had just skipped like 3 levels of interviews that you know, at that point, me getting into programming was a virtual certainty. So you're never sure, and I guess there's a point here, you're never sure whether trying to get an EBCD printer to work with an ASCII machine is worth the time and the effort. But nothing's ever really wasted, because the fact that you could do it counted for a lot later on. I must be boring you to tears. You guys look like you're about to fall asleep here.
It's mostly because we've probably gotten like 3 hours of sleep a night for the whole conference.
I know the feeling. I took the E train last night to get to my hotel, and they didn't tell me there are 2 stops on 53rd Street. I stepped off about 8 feet away from the Hudson River and had to walk all the way over to East 53rd on between 3rd and 2nd. And I didn't have to, of course, but I chose to. And so, you know, I got into the hotel room last night. It was like 8 o'clock, and I just put my head down thinking, this is a nice bed. And I woke up, and it was 4 a.m.
All right, so you got into programming. Mm-hmm. So you were programming, what, control code for the system?
The first job I had was in a group called Sodex, which was the system that did service orders. In fact, that was the acronym, Service Order Design Entry Control System, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it produced the service orders for all of New England Tel's operations. We had a paradigm where we'd have 5 characters to put a service code in, what's called the USOC code in the trade. And then you had to skip a character, and then you could have, like, I think it was 35 characters of verbiage beyond that. And it wasn't, I didn't understand why until it was explained to me. They still had these old Model 28 teletype machines out in the service bureaus that IBM had made to work for them, so they could still print the same old service order they had been doing when the clerks produced them on teletype tapes, punch tapes, literally, and sent them by hand. So our system had taken the place of one end of a teletype connection, and that's what we was doing. I did that for, I think it was 2.5 years or something. It was okay. It was an IMS system. Which was the same sort of database they used for the Project Apollo in NASA. In fact, it was designed for that reason, to keep track of the large part count for a typical rocket and so forth. And then after that, I was switched over to a different application, which was on the billing side, a DB2 database with quite a bit of stuff hung off it. We used to bill about $6 billion a year, which in one sense is frightening because, you know, if you make a mistake, you get your name in the paper.
Yeah.
And that wasn't me that said that, by the way. I walked in the first day, and this old database administrator, a guy named George Sharp, who I later got to know well, a very sharp guy. But anyway, he looked me up and down and said, "Do you know your stuff?" You know, I said, "Oh, I'm the best you'll ever see, George." And he turned his head, and the guys beside him start chuckling and grabbing their hands and everything. And he looked at me up and down, and he said, "When you screw up here, you get your picture in the paper." That's how important an application was. And it's, as far as I know, it's still printing your long-distance phone bill if you live in the New England area. And I did that for about 6 years, and was promoted twice. I mean, you know, I was making a living at it. It wasn't quite what I had expected it to be. We weren't doing anything cutting edge, exactly the opposite, in fact. It was day-to-day input, process, and output, and don't make any mistakes. And okay, you know, I made a living at it. But I had an insight, and if I do say so myself, I credit myself greatly for having had it. I was asked to help put in a work-at-home arrangement for a woman who was a key player on one of the teams. They were working on a critical project, and they wanted to keep her productive. She was going on a pregnancy leave, and I said, "Well, we'll give you a terminal you can use at your house, you know, as long as you can." And they knew I had been in the craft, of course, so I knew who to call and what equipment would be needed. And we got her set up with a genuine IBM 3278 character-based terminal and a Cisco 2500 some series router with an ISDN card in it and a real honest-to-God ISDN line, which was a vice presidential privilege at the time, because if you bonded the two B channels together, you could get, wait for it, 128 kilobits a second of data transfer. Yeah, I know. But at the time, it was pretty good. It was a very big deal. And we got it set up. We were using an email system called PROFS. I forgot what the acronym stood for, but that was the email of the IBM world. And she sent me an email message. "Thanks a lot. This is just like being at work. It's really nice, you know, really, really fast and everything." And I was sitting at my desk in 125 High Street in Boston. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that screen, and I said to myself, if they can move this job 10 miles, they can move it 10,000. I picked Sri Lanka. Yeah, I thought, no, really, that was the hotbed of software development at the time. I thought Arthur C. Clarke lived in Sri Lanka. That's probably where all this will go. And so I knew right away I had to get out of it. And that was just the start of a year-long effort, a very, very hard effort to promote myself and lobby aggressively for a job in the hardware end of the business. Again, I was selected for a job in engineering. And a month before I left, they announced that COBOL maintenance was going to India. And the rest, as we know, is history. There was a marked changeover in the software development and maintenance industries in the U.S. It's just within a year after that, it was all gone. It had just vanished.
I think that's actually really interesting, because I think a lot of people always think that outsourcing for IT has been, it's kind of like a new phenomenon, where really it's been going on for ages and ages.
Oh, of course. And that was 94. There had been a lot of adventures in that sort of stuff on U.S. firms. I won't mention the names, but some of the companies that came in and promised they could redo our system for us and make it super-duper... And assure us it would do everything, including wash the baby and walk the dog. And it turns out their chief job talent was lying through their teeth, because they couldn't do anything of the stuff they claimed to be able to do. And they wound up trying to do an in-house effort to redo the billing system so that they were more responsive, could give better information, and so forth and so on. And it ruined the career of a very good guy, a third liner, who was well respected, because they made the fatal mistake of trying to dig business rules out of the spaghetti code you get when you have coders just trying to implement the latest rules change and the latest tariff and so forth and so on. They thought they were going to get the the business rules and reasons out of that code and couldn't be done.
Yeah, I think I was talking about this. We had Leisha with Geeks Without Bounds on last night, and we were talking about a similar thing about how hers specifically was the internationalization of code. And I definitely think it's a good point that we've gotten a lot better, I think, about making sure that so when we are writing code, we aren't putting stuff like business rules in. But I think that's something that companies still struggle with.
Of course.
Sure. Because they don't think about it.
Well, it's as much a problem of I'd say habit, but it's not the right word. It's a problem of the institution and the way they view machines. And everybody who's in the position of supervising these sorts of operations and the coders who make them possible wants everything well-defined and well-documented and perfect and working just right. They can't abide the thought of unpredictable change. There's two reasons for that. And the first reason was that most of the people in IS at the time had gone there because they didn't want to be someplace else. It was a traditional escape from the sales pressure of the business sales office. And I mean pressure, where your annual review and your annual bonus could depend on whether you had remembered to pick up the phone every 3 minutes and tell the customer you were still working on their problem on every single call. So a lot of the guys that were doing that took it was literally called this, the programmer basic training course, and started doing computer programming. And needless to say, the only rule was don't get caught making any mistake, and that was pretty much what they wanted to do. I don't say I was better than them, but I certainly was naive compared to them as to the real business functions we were expected to accomplish. And what it boiled down to was that as long as we made the batch window, nobody cared about whether it worked perfectly in theory. As long as we made the batch window, that was all that counted. And so we had a lot of spaghetti in our code.
Yeah, that's another good point. Is just there's two ways to release code. It's when it's done, so you have a set function list, or you have a deadline. And I feel like deadlines usually always end up getting more spaghetti code because everybody tries to have it all. So usually if you have a set deadline, you drop functionality. And if you have a function list, then you get long development windows. But if you try to have both, I think you usually end up with something you could serve up for dinner.
it's an old problem, and it was compounded by the isolation of the Bell system and all of its people from the commercial world. We had a number of people who had expertise in business coding outside the phone company came in. And the first guy who tried to head a major project told people, you have a month to get this done. And there was so much pushback and wailing and gnashing of teeth that he had to stand up in a meeting and say, this is routine in the commercial world. You tell people they have a short deadline so that they pay attention to the important stuff right up front. And, you know, then you negotiate. All of the Ma Bell, all of the 9X people had said, absolutely not, we can't do that, et cetera. And they just wouldn't abide any prevarication, if you will, and the guy had to get the message the hard way. So it was a very different world in that sense. But as I say, I had to get out of it and did manage to find a place in engineering. And the only bad note was the engineering headquarters that I was going to be working in was about 42 miles away from my home.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I said to my wife, I said, well, you know, I should take this job because I'm at the age where men get a sports car or a mistress or a new job, so how about 2 out of 3? And my wife gave me one of those looks, and she said, how much would a mistress cost? And I said, something else. I was thinking of something else, and perhaps a new car, you know. And I did wind up getting a new car out of it, although a year-end model, but I did get a new Buick out of it. And started doing that commute every day. I lasted in the engineering space for 7 years, roughly 6 years, something like that. And one of the best and wisest managers I'd ever known wound up retiring. And I was cast adrift for various reasons, among other people. I was responsible for the E911 system in New England for a time, and had a partner in New York, and we handled E911 and the 9X footprint. And finally, long story short, I was told I'd be working for a person I considered to be utterly incompetent, a vicious and unprincipled manager who shall, of course, remain nameless. And I flat out refused to do it. But little did I know that she had friends in higher places, and by and by, I got offered a new job in another division. And the existing third liner, her boss, said, "No, you're going to stay here, and you are going to work for her." And that turned out to be a very, very sad, miserable time in my life. And I didn't like her, and she didn't like me. And, you know, she finally called me kike behind my back, and I had to just put on the brakes real hard and say, "I've taken all I can take from you." And, I mean, there's a company hotline you're supposed to call, or there was at the time, and they were properly officious and promised to see if anybody else complained. And Brenna Brith was pretty good. They were amazingly helpful, in fact. I mean, they made it clear they had to have proof. But
yeah,
they told me what was possible and what was likely, and from that, you know, we could proceed to get some progress. And I finally wound up calling the rabbi at Temple Shalom, as I recall, which I used to drive by on the way to work, and I told him, "You know, I'm not of your faith. I'm a Unitarian. But if she's doing this to me, she's doing it to others, and I want to burn it for her." And the rabbi said, "No, that's for revenge. You can't do it." And I said, "Well, he's the guy that should know. I guess I better let this go." And for a time, I started acting Jewish, which is a classic case of Stockholm Syndrome, of course. And the guys that were really Jewish said, "You know, you better stop that." And frankly, I got the opinion from the way they talked about it that this was kind of routine in their world, and they thought I should toughen up. But that's a pitiable thing in itself. But suffice to say, I was in a position where I just couldn't please the woman, and wound up giving her ammunition that she used to pencil me out. So I was given an offer to leave in 2002. There was a big downsizing happening.
Yeah.
And as fate would have it, one of those amazing things that happens now and then, we had lamb for dinner one night, and I wound up in an emergency room at 3 a.m., sick as a dog. Literally, I'll save you the gory details, but literally as bad as I'd ever been at any time in my life. And they finally said, along about 6 a.m. or 7 a.m., "Okay, this is a gallbladder attack, and your insurance doesn't like us. We're going to transfer you to another hospital, but don't worry about it. We'll give you something for the ride." I remember them loading me on the ambulance. They gave me an injection, and I remember them loading me on the ambulance. And the next thing I remember was looking at the lights in the operating theater when they put me on the table 12 and a half hours later.
Wow.
Yeah. And I asked the anesthesiologist who was waiting there for me as I woke up. Little did I know, that's kind of unusual. But I said to him, "You know, what did they give me?" And he said it was dilaudid. And I said, "That's nice. What is it?" He said, "It's synthetic heroin." And I said, "No." And I'm going to tell him, of course, you know, but I told him that's impossible. I didn't get high. And he got the laugh of his life out of that one. He thought that was very funny. He said, "That's not what it does. That's not what, you know, that's not what that stuff does." And I'll never forget it. I said, "You mean all this lying and stealing and killing is also you can check out of the world for 12 and a half hours?" Yeah, he just looked casual and said, "Yeah, that's what they want. That's what it does." And I said, "Well, I don't want to be part of any world they're in." But the funny part was that, and the next day I had the surgeon came in and told me I now held the record for the longest laparoscopic gallbladder removal in the hospital's history. "Yeah, sure." And I said, "Well, that's nice. It's kind of hot in here. Could you turn down the thermostat?" And he said, "Well, we can look into that." And he reached in his pocket and pulled out a cell phone. This is back when they were still banned in hospitals. And he said something about emergency spiral CAT scan. And 20 minutes later, I was in this device they had just kicked some other guy out of, brand new, not even the walls painted. And 20 minutes after that, I was back in the bed, and they were hanging in three or four more bags next to me. And he was telling me I had had a cardiopulmonary event.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. Apparently, I had tossed a clot and had a pulmonary edema. So he had to, you know, make sure that I was going to stay there. He said, "We're going to have to do some tests." And 2 weeks later, you know, they're still doing tests on my my blood work. And finally did find out that I have some rare mutation, which is peculiar to people with virus heritage, that causes my blood to clot too readily. And I have to take, I've got this medic alert on, and I have to take a blood thinner every day, so I don't have that that risk of blood clots anymore. But, and of course, before you fall asleep or your eyes glaze over, I'll just tell you why I tell you this long, dreary story. During that 2 weeks, I drifted over a magic number of some sort where the phone company couldn't fire me because the combination of my age and seniority added up to some statutory limit. They couldn't just cut me loose. They had to retire me. So technically, I'm a Verizon retiree, albeit a somewhat bitter one, as you can tell. And ever since then, I've been doing contract work and doing what I can to keep body and soul together. And at roughly 2007, I took over the Telecom Digest. The previous moderator had had a stroke and was in trouble and asked me to help out. So I said, yeah, and I wound up doing it ever since.
Well, that is probably a very exhaustive, good introduction to your talk that's coming up. That timing, it was 5 o'clock, right?
Yes, it is.
5 o'clock. Do we have a program? Let's look up which room he's going to be
in. It's the third column, and I think it's the one in the back. But
So Olson?
Yes, I believe so. Echoes of Returns Lost.
The History of the Telecom Digest. Yes, that's in Olson.
Uh-huh.
So Olson at 5 o'clock.
Okay. I'll talk mostly about the Digest, I promise.
We're probably... we need to... get going. We have some more people, I think, waiting on us. But it was great having you on. We look forward to seeing you again. Was this your... one more quick question. Was this your first time at the Hope Conference?
Yes, it was. Bernie S. called me up and asked me to submit a proposal to be considered. And I said, okay, I will. And the rest is, you know.
Have you really enjoyed it? Has it been good?
Oh, it's been fantastic.
What's
sure.
been your favorite part?
Realizing I could walk 8 blocks if I had to. mostly the quick lectures, guys bringing in ham radios and stuff like that and talking about other things. That was a high point. And, of course, the interview between Daniel Ellsberg and Ed Snowden. I was astonished at their camaraderie and how Snowden was impressed with our standing ovation. It seemed to have affected him greatly.
Well, that's great. It was great having you on.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you're at the conference, you should definitely check out his talk in Olson.
At 5 o'clock.
At 5 o'clock.
I'll leave you with my father's old saying. Whenever I started mouthing off to him, he'd say, Bill, you could talk the ears off a brass monkey.
All right. Well, listeners, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be back real quick.